colleague on this bill. This legislation is modeled on legislation that was passed in a couple of states, Florida, I believe, first. And what it does, I'm representing Philip Morris today, by the way. What it does is essentially cap the supersedious undertaking, which is a lawyer word for appeal bond, in cases where there are very large judgments against tobacco product manufacturers which are making payments to the state under the master settlement agreement or related legislation. And I want to give a kind of a factoid that I found interesting that I learned recently, and this is in the case of Philip Morris. Out of every pack of cigarettes which we sell, roughly four times as much money out of the proceeds of that sale goes to state and federal government in the form of excise taxes or payments under the MSA as goes to the company in the form of profit. Four times as much to government as goes in the form of profit. So I think it is clear to all of us who follow the budget process that source of revenue is an increasingly important element of the state revenue profile, certainly following the multi-state settlement agreement. We're talking about figures that are so far to date. Our figures show the state has received roughly $92.7 million and is scheduled to receive in 2001 $72.2 million, 86.8 in 2002, 87.6 in 2003. That's just under the MSA, not counting the excise tax. And if you just look at the number of programs that are potentially impacted, if that stream of revenue were compromised, I think you can appreciate what the potential impact of a verdict that, in effect, forces one or more of these companies into bankruptcy would be on the state of Oregon. Bill's going to talk a little bit about what this bill does not do, but I want to just stress one thing that it does not do. It does not limit damages. This is not a damage limitation. It is an appeal bond limitation, so to make sure that if there is one of these angle-sized verdicts, huge verdicts, at least you can get into the appellate process without being forced into potential bankruptcy by the size of that verdict, which could be, in the case of the angle, which is $100 billion plus, is basically unbondable. I think all of us are reminded by recent goings on with PG&E in California, that bankruptcy filing by a century-old company that was a model of financial stability, that events can occur, financial impacts can occur, that can place even the strongest financial, strongest balance sheet company into an untenable position. And the key thing I guess I want to leave with you is that in this case, because of the state's role as a beneficiary of the proceeds, the state is truly at risk, even more than the shareholders of at least Philip Morris, should that event occur, because those are funds that that the state depends upon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Any questions? Bill Linden?
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden representing R.J. Reynolds. Let me add just a couple of general points, and then I'll get into some do's and dozens about this bill. In Oregon, the appeal bond requirement is set by statute, and it requires that the amount of the judgment plus costs and interest be posted as an appeal bond. Courts do have some discretion to alter that bond. However, in Oregon, it's quite limited. For example, the court rules in Oregon defer to the statute to determine the amount of the bond, and our courts here don't have any constitutional or statutory authority to set court rules relating to the size of bonds on appeal. Mr. Gardner referenced the Engle case in Florida. That's the type of situation we're trying to get at with this piece of legislation. That was a $145 billion judgment against four tobacco companies. That case includes a whole variety of rulings made by the trial court judge that have been appealed. The dilemma that companies faced in that case was under Florida law, they were required to post 125% of the amount of the judgment. That was some $180 billion. It was out of the question. There was absolutely no way any of the companies could comply with their share of that and not bankrupt themselves. So Florida, in response, set a bonding cap at $100 million. What that did was allow these appealable issues, and there are many, many in that case, to proceed forward. Just like the bill that we're talking about today, that Florida law did not in any way limit the amount of damages that could be sought and received in these types of cases. It simply allowed the defendants in that case to have recourse to an appeal in a matter in which they thought there were many appealable issues. What this bill doesn't do, if you were to adopt it and the Dash 1 amendment that we're supporting, and that was drafted at our request, what this bill doesn't do is affect any cases in Oregon in which judgments have been filed prior to the effective date of this act. The Dash 1 amendment specifically talks about the applicability date, whereas the bill as printed did not. So to cover that concern, the concern that this might affect cases in which judgments have already been filed, we are bringing forward the Dash 1 amendments for your consideration if you decide to take this matter up in a work session. As Mr. Gardner mentioned, this bill does not have anything to do whatsoever in terms of limiting the amount of damages that are available in these types of cases in Oregon. It also doesn't apply to any tobacco companies who did not sign on to the Master Settlement Agreement. It is very narrow in its scope of who it affects. What it does do is does provide some protection to those companies who signed the Master Settlement Agreement in the sense of providing a reasonable assurance that if we have a large judgment in this case, we will have an opportunity to appeal that judgment. And it also does provide some protection to the revenue stream from the MSA in Oregon. If as a matter of policy you decide that's an important revenue stream to protect, this is one way you can do it, because an Engel-sized verdict in this state would have the same impact on the tobacco companies who signed that agreement as it would have had in Florida had they been forced to post $180 billion worth to appeal that case. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions the committee might have.
Sure. What language in this bill limits it to just those tobacco companies that are part of the Master Settlement Agreement?
Mr. Chair, I believe it is page 1, line 19, but I don't have that ORS right handy. If I can, want me to check that, Mr. Chair?
Actually, we'll have staff counsel.
Yeah, I believe that's the provision, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll just verify that. Any other questions? Okay. No questions. There'll probably be more as time goes on.
Sure. Hey, Pete Shepard, for an opposing opinion. Where's Ingrid?
She's here. She was here.
Is she here?
She was.
Okay. Ingrid here. Go ahead, Pete.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. We're opposed to Senate Bill 837. Because we don't think the underlying rationale is correct. And that underlying rationale is that this bill will help protect Oregon's master settlement agreement proceeds from significant long-term disruption. And let me just give you our view on how that that would play out. Suppose Company A goes bankrupt in the form of bankruptcy that involves actually shutting down its operation and liquidating its assets. Under the master settlement agreement, the money owed Oregon is based on the total number of cigarettes shipped by participating manufacturers, not on the market share of any individual manufacturer. The customer base of Company A is addicted, and we believe they will switch to other companies. And in the current state of affairs, at least, almost all the cigarettes available are available from other companies that are participating in the master settlement agreement. And so the total number of cigarettes shipped subject to the master settlement agreement then wouldn't change dramatically, we believe, in the long run, even in the event of a liquidation-style bankruptcy. And so Oregon's stream of income, while it might be disrupted, would not be overturned. Another form of bankruptcy would be that the company continues business and under the protection of a bankruptcy court, and so is protected to a measure from claims of various creditors. Even here, we think that the likely long-term outcome of such a bankruptcy would be that Oregon's stream, the stream of income payable to Oregon and to the other states would not be at least permanently overturned. And the reason for that is that there's a business reason why these companies agreed to enter into the master settlement agreement and why most manufacturers in the market have joined the master settlement agreement as subsequent participating manufacturers. One of those business reasons is that it's a way of managing the risk that states will sue them for various forms of violation of law, because the master settlement agreement provides for a centralized dispute resolution mechanism. There are other advantages to companies in participating in the master settlement agreement or joining it if they weren't originally participants. A bankrupt entity has the option of reaffirming obligations that it has going into the bankruptcy. So we think there are some business reasons why a business, even in a reorganization-style bankruptcy, might want to reaffirm the obligations of the master settlement agreement. And second, even a reorganized company emerging from bankruptcy would be required to comply with Oregon's non-participating manufacturer statute. This statute was adopted as part of the master settlement agreement in order to level the playing field between companies that participate in the master settlement agreement and those that choose not to. A company that chooses not to, a non-participating manufacturer, must pay an amount into an escrow account that is calculated to be the rough approximation of what the company would owe under the master settlement agreement. And so even a company emerging from bankruptcy, if it successfully shed its obligations under the master settlement agreement, would still be required to comply with our non-participating manufacturer statute. And so there wouldn't be, we don't think, a great economic advantage to a reorganized company in not subsequently rejoining the master settlement agreement. So for those reasons, we are skeptical of the underlying rationale that's been advanced for this bill.
All right, so if I understand correctly, what you're telling me is that if one of these companies went bankrupt, it's really no big deal. It's just going to take a while for some other manufacturer to pick up the load.
That would be our projection, Senator Minnis, in the event that the company actually shut its doors and liquidated its assets.
I see. Okay, so are there any positive sides to this particular piece of legislation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not able to identify one. I might just mention another factor here, and it's illustrated, I think, by the testimony you've already heard, and that is that even if we in Oregon pass such a statute, there are an awful lot of other states that have not done so. And a bankruptcy, if the rationale for the bill is correct, then Oregon would be exposed to the consequences of that bankruptcy if it were triggered by a judgment in another state. And that, of course, this legislature can't do anything about.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Harper first, and then Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see two actions in this bill. One is the master settlement agreement, of which we can argue either way, but the other one is just the fairness. Why shouldn't there be a cap on this bond? That, to me, is a much bigger issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I believe that there are others here who can speak more to the sort of policy issue as to why there ought or ought not to be a cap. As a general notion, what the current Oregon law reflects is that the size of the bond on appeal reflects something about what a jury or judge, the magnitude of the wrong that a jury or judge has found as a result of a trial. And so there is built into the current system some sense of proportionality between the magnitude of the wrong and the size of the bond required on appeal. I grant you that the size of the bond for example, the Engle case, it's very large. There's no question about that.
Even by government standards.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I have two questions, I guess. The first one, we heard the comment that we recognize the amendment takes care of the Williams situation here in Oregon, and so they would be protected. But we were hearing the statement that this has absolutely no bearing on the judgment. I'm just curious, from your standpoint as Assistant AG, where you agree or disagree with that statement, forgetting your other philosophy about the, I'm just asking you now in your other role, do you see this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, I confess that I haven't thought about the question prior to your asking it. And I think what I'd like to do is study the bill in more detail and provide my answer to you.
I would like to hear your answer on that.
You state the question for me.
Well, my question is, if recall, I don't recall this, who made the statement, or that this kind of legislation would have no bearing. I'm talking about the future now, because the Williams case is exempted from this. But in the future, this would have no bearing on the judgment that came out of a court case. That's a separate issue, and I think I'm seeing the good former senator nodding his head back there. Okay, and that's why I was asking him his opinion as an assistant AG, not his testimony dealing with what he's talking about today, but that particular issue, what was his reaction to that? The other thing I wanted to know, Mr. Chair, and that I heard a lot of states have not moved this direction. Did you say some states have adopted legislation this way? I'd be curious, Mr. Chair, what the Office of the Attorney General in each of those states has said on that particular issue, and what their experience is with, if the law is in effect. Would that be possible to get that information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, on that question, we did, when this bill first came to our attention, we queried the National Association of Attorneys General to try and get information about that very question. And unfortunately, the National Association hasn't compiled in one location any kind of report of views of attorneys general on this issue in any state in which the idea has been proposed. I do know that the state of Florida, you heard from the testimony earlier, that the state of Florida has adopted a limitation. I believe that's in a greater amount than the bill that you have before you. I think I'm correct in saying that Florida has a limit of $100 million. I could be incorrect on that, but I believe that's correct. And I do not know what position the Florida Attorney General's office took when that legislation was proposed. That also I can find out. That piece of it I can find out for you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, is there any provision in existing law? You said that the amount of bond is supposed to be commensurate with the award that might be awarded. Is there any provision for factoring in the financial financial condition of the company, in theory that a bankrupt company couldn't provide any damages? So is there already any provision in the law for setting that bond on that criterion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I don't know the answer to that question. The state rarely recovers judgments in the amounts we're talking about here, and so I haven't had occasion to deal with that myself. I do believe some of the subsequent witnesses can answer that for you, Harmon.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Pete, do you know of Any other state? I maybe for counsel here, but do other states have more flexible procedures for judges to grant a lower amount in an appeal bond?
I'm afraid I don't know, Mr. Chair.
One of the questions we have here is, why do this just for cigarette companies? Why not allow some provision for a judge to hear mm-hmm. some motion to lower the bond and mm-hmm. make that a judgment of the court? So just throw that out there and see what we get. All right. Any other questions? Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. All right. Josh Alpert. Olat, is that right? Olat. Now, what is Olat? Is that your last name or is that an organization?
Hey, it shows how connected I am.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Joshua Alpert here today representing the Oregon Health Leadership Against Tobacco, or OLAT, a coalition comprised of the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, and the American Cancer Society. OLAT is in opposition to Senate Bill 837. Please excuse my voice. I'm getting over my third bout of the flu this session. At a time when the public health community is fighting a war not only against the lethal impacts of tobacco, but also against special interest groups trying to convince legislators that tobacco is a product that Oregon should be endorsing, passage of Senate Bill 837 would undermine these hard-fought efforts. To have the Oregon legislature sanction legislation that would allow a loophole for big tobacco sends a message throughout Oregon that it is okay to market products that have lethal effects, that it's okay to market products that target children, minorities, and women. Several years ago, Oregon Attorney General Hardy Myers joined almost all other states' attorneys general in a lawsuit against five of the largest tobacco manufacturers. The result was the 1998 Master Settlement Agreement, in which the five tobacco manufacturers must pay to Oregon roughly $100 million every year in perpetuity. That was a step in the right public health policy direction, as it proved to Oregonians and states around the nation that Oregon was not going to put up with these tobacco manufacturers' business practices, that they must in fact pay Oregon back for all of the financial damage tobacco has caused the state in terms of health care, and that they must in fact pay Oregon to ensure that we never have to pay for smoking-related health care costs again. Passage of Senate Bill 837 would be several steps backwards along the appropriate and rational road of saving lives, as it sends the message that Oregon in fact feels that tobacco manufacturers deserve a break. Tobacco use is lethal, and those responsible for it deserve to pay. They certainly do not deserve a special exemption. For these reasons, the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, and the American Lung Association oppose Senate Bill 837. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions? There are none.
Great.
Go get well.
Thank you.
All right. Bill Gaylord and Chuck Thoman.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Bill Gaylord.
I'd like to introduce Mayola Williams
and her daughter Joanne
Williams Branch,
who are with us in the room today. There's been reference here to the Williams case, and these are the Williamses of the Williams case. Chuck Talman and I are two of the four lawyers who represent the Williams in the appeal of the case that was tried 2 years ago in Portland and has, as we speak, the only judgment in the state of Oregon, I believe, in the history of the state of Oregon, on behalf of smokers against a tobacco company for the problems caused by smoking tobacco. I want to address Senator Duncan's question, if I may, briefly, because I think it's good to have a clear understanding of what is at stake here and what is not. I'm going to take the Attorney General's word for it. This is not about the Master Settlement Agreement. I know it recites the Master Settlement Agreement and says that the rationale for this change in Oregon law is the Master Settlement Agreement, but the effect of this change in the law is not about the Master Settlement Agreement. It's about bonds on appeals in private lawsuits. That's all it's about. A bond does nothing except preserve the status quo in the case while a case is appealed, so that the party that has been found liable in a lawsuit
doesn't pay the money yet. In the absence of a bond, they can pay the money, or the process of execution can be undertaken. Garnishments can be issued, property can be attached, and the status quo can be changed pending the appeal. The appeal can still go forward, but the money can be paid in the meantime, to be paid back if the losing party in the trial wins in the appeal, or not if they don't. All the bond does is allow the defendant who's lost a judgment to avoid paying while they appeal their case. The other thing the bond does, and what's really at stake here, is the prioritization of individuals in various lawsuits in various states and whether or not Oregonians get fair treatment. When this bill was not amended and was just simply an attack on the only judgment in history of Oregon on behalf of people against tobacco, it was an unwarranted special break for big tobacco against these good people that are in the room today. Now that it's apparently going to be amended, it's just as bad an idea for the sake of the other 3 million plus Oregonians who might somehow have a claim someday against a tobacco company. That's very hypothetical. There is not a single case pending in Oregon. There's not a single case ever filed in Oregon that could possibly bring about this change, bring into play this statute that's being proposed. Philip Morris, in the Williams case, the evidence showed was worth $17 billion, not including their beer business, their cheese business, their Nabisco food business that they now own, or any of their international tobacco business, just their domestic tobacco business. In today's report from Bonnie Herzog of Credit Suisse First Boston, who's the designated international expert on the value of tobacco as a stock, she says Philip Morris and Reynolds all outperformed the tobacco the market last week, and she goes on and explains that in great detail. And that's been true week in, week out for all these years that there's been litigation going on against the tobacco industry. They have all the money they need. They have all the money to pay all the proposed judgments against them. This is primarily about bad symbolism. Florida is one state that apparently honored the potential victims' lawsuits four times as valuable as this bill would have you honor bonds on appeals in Oregon. You might ask yourselves, I ask you, why would Oregon victims of tobacco be entitled to one-fourth as much security for their potential judgments as Florida victims of tobacco? You might ask yourself, why is this bill introduced to us as an export from...
Excuse me, sir.
Maybe everybody else, I missed something on the bill. Would you run through that last part again?
Yeah. the Florida bill sets the bond maximum at $100 million. This bill sets the Oregon maximum at $25 million. That means that Oregon victims in future lawsuits would be entitled to only a fourth as much security on the appeal of their claim against a tobacco company as a Florida victim, assuming somebody got a verdict in of that range of size against a tobacco company in Oregon. I don't know what the rationale for that is. I haven't heard anybody mention one. I don't know what one would be. There is a rationale for why these bills got started and got exported here. I believe they started in Virginia. Virginia is the home of much of the tobacco industry and a lot of their assets. If you're a victim of tobacco in Virginia, if they have no bond whatsoever, you've still got a pretty decent chance of collecting your judgment when the appeal is over. You can go attach buildings. I don't know of any buildings that the tobacco industry owns in the state of Oregon. I don't know of any major assets that would be available as an alternative to the bond. The bond is much more important to a person in Oregon who has a judgment against a tobacco company. I think the main thing to mention to you, and I'll stop at that point, is this sends just the worst possible message. This is the Oregon legislature being asked to basically comment on a request by the tobacco industry, for the tobacco industry, for special interest legislation, a special favor to the tobacco industry. This is not all the defendants in all the judgments on appeal in Oregon coming in saying, we think our bond law is unfair. This is not manufacturers at large generally coming in and saying, we think we need a better way to manage the judgments and verdicts in Oregon while the appeal process runs. This is tobacco coming in saying, we tobacco needs special treatment from you, the legislature.
Senator
and
Harper,
the message that sends is the worst possible.
Senator Harper.
So you wouldn't be averse to expanding this to cover all companies, just to take a look at the whole bond issue?
Absolutely not.
It's a special interest aspect.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, the special interest aspect of this is what is the worst about its symbolism. The concept of eliminating bonds on appeal or restricting them irrationally in relationship to the value of judgments. Understand that our civil justice system is not primarily about individuals or their families and lawsuits for tort liability against international companies. It's primarily about doing the business of disputes between businesses. Bonds are there for everybody that ever gets a judgment against anybody else during the period of time that they choose to appeal. I dare say a huge percentage of all the bonds at any one time in Oregon, supersedious bonds on judgments, are placed in favor of companies that have judgments against someone else. It would really mess things up to start tampering with the concept of bonding on appeal of judgments in general. I don't think anybody's suggesting that seriously.
So now, did I just hear you say correctly that you wouldn't mind if we kind of muddled around with the bond issue?
Oh, no, I would absolutely mind.
You would mind. Why would you mind?
Because, as I said, bonds are an important part of the process of protecting a party who wins their lawsuit while the other party hasn't let go of it and continues to appeal it.
So would you oppose giving judges discretion?
You know, I heard that comment, and Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I don't mean to avoid the question except to say I'm honestly not that sure they don't have some discretion right now. I'd want a chance to review that.
You made it perfectly clear, would you?
Discretion is one thing, standards are another. I think there's room for standards to be adopted for alternatives to cash bonds, and that I think that may be. See, that's my problem, is I'm not sure that isn't already in our law. I think there are alternatives to cash bonds that are available. The point is security. You know, would we be sitting here talking about mortgage lenders being required to accept 10% collateral on the debts that they lend money on? Would we be sitting here talking about business obligations being required to be secured by 10% of the value of whatever is at stake in the business deal? That's what this is. This is a business concept. This is collateral for a debt.
All right, hang on a second. Counsel, you want to read the statute?
Okay, the relevant statute is ORS 19.310 sub 2. It says the trial court may waive, reduce, or loan an undertaking on appeal upon a showing of good cause, including indigence, and on such terms as are just and equitable.
All right. And if the tobacco companies can come in here and show indigence, which is what they're threatening us all with here, really, then presumably they can get an exception to the bond requirement when a jury in Oregon orders them to pay $146 billion to Oregon smokers. That is all highly hypothetical. But it's a bad idea.
Senator Duncan.
You could say that again. They could do that right now.
That is
yes.
The current law now. Now, there's no one here from the Judicial Department, and I know that at times that we've heard in other testimony, the courts are hesitant, absent more clear direction, to exercise discretion, and this may be, in fact, one of those situations.
I might add this, just because this thought is triggered by some of the questions here, if I may finish this way. To the extent that it's true that only a few states have done this sort of thing, and I believe that's true, one of the effects of what you're being asked to do here today is to put Oregon prospective possible judgment holders against tobacco companies behind all of those states that have no such restriction when judgments are issued in those states. The ultimate effect of collateral is we're dividing up a limited pie. If we were to divide up the tobacco industry as a limited pie among Oregon and all the other states, this would say Oregonians get the hind end.
I just find this whole thing kind of absurd because, I mean, in the sense that, you know, the attorneys general took on this particular case and they were successful, but I think the logic behind it all is very interesting. terms of attorneys general getting involved in a case that argues that a particular product, you know, ends with a specific result and therefore there should be damages due. Yet we continue to promote lotteries and sell alcohol and other kinds of things that, you know, it's a little disingenuous because we should be suing ourselves. Any further comments?
Don't give them any ideas. Don't give them any ideas. All right.
Ms. Williams, thank you for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let's see. Anybody want to make an additional comment? No?
We're addicted to
that. Any other questions from the committee?
Smoking.
If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 837. We're ready. We're going to call Senator Atkinson. He's on the next bill. I don't think so.
We haven't had 100 years.
Good.
Chair, we don't even get a consideration. We're just told.
Senate Bill 665, Senator Jason Atkinson.
Which bill is he on, please?
665.
Oh, thank you. That's the very first one.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator for District 25. Today, I bring to you Senate Bill 665. This is an issue that Senator Beyer, Roger Beyer, has worked on, and is an issue that really grabbed my attention about 6 months ago. And this bill is being introduced at the request of a friend of mine who is also here today to testify on behalf of this measure. What this bill does is it requires an applicant to provide a birth certificate or photo ID before they renew, Department of Transportation, specifically DMV, issues, renews, or replaces a duplicate ID card, driver's permit, or driver's license. Since the time that this bill has been scheduled for a hearing, the Department of Transportation has expressed some interest. I believe they'll probably talk today. And at the offset of my remarks, I want you to know that I'm very flexible as far as trying to put an end to a problem that Steve will explain here in just a moment. Let me introduce Pastor Steve Hopkins. Steve currently is a resident of Roger Byers District in Mount Angel. Before he was here, Steve was spent some time of his career as a police officer in Southern Oregon. With that background and the experiences that he had with his daughter's ID being stolen, he is actually the one who came up with this preliminary idea to try to put an end to that. With that, I will stay for any questions that you may have, but I'd be more than happy at this point to turn it over to Steve.
Okay. Any questions for the nice senator? If not, sir, just state your name for the record, please, and go ahead and...
Sure. My name is Steve Hopkins, and I live in Mount Angel, Oregon.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to just express to you or share with you an incident that happened to me just this last year. On or about July 15th of the year 2000, my daughter Danielle, who would be here to testify if she could today, but she is presently in Spain as an exchange student, she and her friends had gone into downtown Portland to take in a concert, and they parked their car downtown. My daughter put her purse in the back of her trunk, locked it there. Apparently someone had seen her do that, and they pried open her trunk and were able to successfully remove her wallet, which had in it several credit cards, a student ID card, a social security card, and some miscellaneous personal items, and several blank checks from two separate banking institutions. The matter was reported to the police, and the banks were notified, and all accounts were closed. But in spite of our efforts, in the months to follow, I began to receive a barrage of letters from collection agencies for checks that had been written on my daughter's account by people who had stolen the checks. One of the forged documents was dated July 24th, the year 2000, just 9 days after my daughter had her purse stolen, and it was written to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Apparently, the folks had the people that stolen the checks had gone in and were able to pay for stolen identification or fraudulently obtained identification with one of her checks. I then went down to the Woodburn, which is closest to me, Department of Motor Vehicles, and I just inquired about this. And I learned that a duplicate driver's license was issued to my daughter or issued to someone other than my daughter on that day, July 24th. I inquired further and also learned how little was required to obtain a duplicate license or identification or permit from the Department of Motor Vehicles. I was told by a person who I can name but choose not to at this point that all that is needed to prove one's identity are two pieces of identification. They accept a social security card, a bank card, or anything with a name on it. And to my surprise, I was told that DMV would even accept as one of those two pieces of identification something as simple as a letter with the applicant's name addressed on it. I inquired further why they didn't require photo ID to get a duplication, and they advise that the applicant does not need to produce a photograph of themselves to obtain a driver's license, identification, or permit, because DMV has a computer system with their driver's license holder's picture on it. I inquired, why then did you not produce a picture? And they said the computer was not working, and I was also advised that the computer had not been working for quite some time. After obtaining this false identification, and may I also, it's not included in my testimony here, but two other people went down and obtained false identification, one of them even being a male, altering my daughter's name from Danielle to Danielle E. Hopkins. Two other people were able to, in the same manner, obtain some false identification. And these suspects had successfully negotiated bad checks in my daughter's account to the tune of about $3,000, and I'm selling that a little bit short. Not to mention, as well, the time that I spent as a dad who has better things to do, responding with letters of affidavit of forgery. I had to write a letter to each one of the collections agencies for at least 30 different checks. Each check required a letter, affidavit of forgery. Trying to contact banks, and you don't talk to real people anymore, you talk to machines, and it gets to be a little bit difficult at times. But a whole lot of time and effort was put into this whole thing. Police were contacted as suddenly this had escalated now. This simple theft case had escalated to a $3,000 theft in the first degree or a forgery case. The police were contacted, or the agency that was investigating it, and advised them of this new activity. And being a former police officer, I know how police departments prioritize cases. This case was reported simply, when my daughter reported it, as a simple theft, a misdemeanor, and there was no active investigation on the matter. I contacted the police with this new information and the amount of $3,000 in hopes that they would elevate the case from a misdemeanor theft or a simple theft to a first-degree theft or a forgery, which would be a felony, and a detective would hopefully would have been assigned to the case. I was advised by the police department that the case would remain a simple misdemeanor theft, and if the suspects were apprehended, the DA would have the option of filing more severe charges. The problem was, of course, that the case was not being investigated, and the suspects were not in danger of being caught. To my knowledge, at this point, these guys have not been caught, and all this is to say that identity theft is becoming a very major crime in the state, and it is more lucrative than bank robbery and much safer because police agencies don't have the time to investigate cases of simple theft, which is how these cases are reported to the police departments, as simple thefts. And I'm in support of this legislation of changing this law because the most common form of identification required by merchants and others to cash checks is a driver's license or an identification card or a driver's permit, which is issued by the Department of Motor Vehicles. And my hope is that by enacting this bill into law, that it will require DMV to accept at least one piece of these two pieces of ID required for a duplication to be a photo ID.
No, I don't.
And before they can issue a duplicate license or identification card. And I know this will not solve all the problems associated with identity theft, but until we are able to more effectively investigate the crime of identity theft, this will be a means, hopefully, of helping protect merchants and citizens from being ripped off by identity thieves.
Now, was that the Portland Police Bureau that you
were... I'm not going to say.
Well, actually, it was. I know it was, but...
Yes.
You know, the threshold in the Portland Police Bureau for fraud investigations is close to $50,000.
It's huge.
Loss. They've got, I think, five detectives.
Yeah. And I have nothing against the Portland Police Bureau. They're wonderful people, and I understand the business, but...
They'd love to be able to do these investigations, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're very limited. Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to, I guess, do a little public testimony here on my own part on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman, for coming forward. Thank you, Senator Atkinson, for not getting my name on the bill. I thought I was on it, but we'll get on it later. I just related my own personal experience just about a year ago, just shy of a year ago, I guess. We had mail stolen out of our mailbox at home. Among other things that were taken was a box of blank checks from our bank, and not to mention a couple of large campaign checks, but fortunately got that stopped before those were cashed by someone else. But one thing that your testimony has reminded me that we haven't done yet, my wife and I both, because after the same process of going through and countless affidavits and credit report or credit agencies contacting and saying they've accepted bad checks. My wife actually called one of the most frequent stores that kept taking these checks and asked them, well, why do you keep taking these checks? We send you an affidavit every day saying the checks have been stolen, yet you keep accepting these checks. They said, well, they showed us ID. And the next question was, well, whose name was on the ID? Because obviously it was someone else's, and I guess we need to, and I hadn't thought about the fact that maybe these people went and had ID made in my wife's name, and so that's how they were able to do it. So I think this is an important issue. As we've heard, identity theft is one of the largest growing, crimes in Oregon, and it's very frustrating when you have your mail stolen out of your mailbox, you can't get federal prosecution, and the state won't prosecute because it's a federal crime. Unfortunately, we had that thrown back in our face a couple of years ago. So this is something we need to look at, and I don't know if the DMV is here. Obviously,
they are here,
and hopefully they will be in support of it. If not, we'll find out.
They're signed up as neutral.
How to make it work if this isn't the answer.
Hey, Ms. Taylor, you want to come up? Actually, I've got a copy of somebody's DMV record that one of our fraud detectives gave to me shortly before session. It's got 15 duplicate license requests in less than 6 months. It's not like a light shouldn't have come on to somebody.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation, and I just want to explain the reason we signed up as neutral is unless the commission has taken a position on a bill, we are neutral, and they haven't taken a position on this bill. So it's not that we're for it or against it. We're just neutral to come and talk about the impact and ways to maybe mitigate the impact. I'd be happy to take a look at that.
What possible impact could there be?
Mr. Chair, the bill, because it requires the photo on all renewals and or a birth certificate to be done.
You mean somebody to actually look at it?
No, Mr. Chair. I'm talking about the ones that are typically today done by mail. People are not going to want to mail in their birth certificate or their photo, probably, and wait for it to come back to them in the mail. So it'll shift workload from what's done at headquarters to the field. Doing a renewal by mail is a less time-consuming, less costly process than it is to do it in a field office and issuing a new photo. And when I met with Senator Atkinson and talked to him about some ways to get to the gist of this bill with maybe not having the financial impact that it does and the need for the limited duration employees, et cetera, that was one of the things that we talked about. I mean, that's one of the big hits. Most original driver's licenses would, you know, applicants would probably already have this because most of our originals are coming in. They're either an out-of-state person coming in with an out-of-state driver's license with their photo on it, or they're a teen coming in with their parent with a birth certificate because they're establishing their identity for the very first time. So this bill really doesn't change much on the original application, but the renewals, it really does hit. And we do more renewals than we do originals or duplicates. I think that the digital photo system that we have, we've only started doing the digital photo, I was trying to remember in the back of the room if it's been 2 or 3 years, but it will take several years to populate the entire file to have everybody come in and have their photo on file. And I think that there is a way to have the system changed to pull the file photo up on all transactions at the individual windows. Currently, the system can pull the file up at the photo station, but that's not necessarily, you have to, ask for it to come up and walk over to a different station, see the photo, and come back. And this bill brings up an idea of actually pulling the photo up at each window. That's a budget decision, and, if it's in the budget, then it's something we could do easily. Now, the record you mentioned about the 15 duplicates, I'd be happy to take a look at it. It is possible that although they're recorded as duplicates, they truly are the change of address by mail.
No, this guy is actually a crook, and he's been arrested.
Oh, okay.
He's using these things to basically cast checks.
Okay.
So I've often thought that your agency should be eliminated and merged with the Department of State Police, because you guys always tell us that you're not a law enforcement agency, you're a licensing entity. But you have a greater role in law enforcement than you know, unfortunately, consistently have been unwilling to take on that role because it always costs too much. Anyway.
Well.
I know. I've heard all this stuff before.
Yeah.
It's been 15 years of this nonsense, and nobody can ever think of any particular way how to handle this stuff. And frankly, I'm a little bit tired of it, especially spending $125 million on a failed system that wouldn't work in terms of computers. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Kelly, it seems like the problem is in line 6, the renewing language. If we remove that, it would considerably solve your problem. That way, if someone's going to be renewed, they could still do that. But if they wanted to issue, replace, or duplicate, then they would have to show up and offer a photo ID.
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, either that or specify in here that it's a transaction that's being done in person. We are going to be phasing out the renew by mail, but it will take a few more years because, we're switching over to last session. You all passed the bill to go to an 8-year driver's license, and that did phase out over time the mail and renewal that's done on a 4-year basis. So not the 2001-03 biennium, but late in the 2003-05 biennium, we will be phasing out the renew by mail. So if you either, like you say, it's really, I think, it sounds like it's not the originals because we already are seeing, like I said, photo, and it's probably not the renewals that are causing the problem. It's the duplicate. And so either to specify that it's a transaction being done in person or to specify that it's duplicates, it will help reduce the cost. It won't negate it completely because it is additional time at the field office, but it'll get to what I think sounds like the root of the problem.
I would say that to wait until we get rid of renewing by mail 2003-05, with that only 40,000 or 50,000 people get their lives ruined between now and then by identity theft. That seems pretty reasonable to me, so let's talk about a different solution.
Oh, Senator Beyer, I wasn't suggesting we wait till that long. I was just telling you that's when, if you took renewal out, there are in-person renewals that are being done, and I was just saying if you would specify that the renewals are, this is all, anything being done in person, that way it will not cause the people who in the meantime would renewing by mail getting a sticker for their license, they could continue to do that and they wouldn't flood into the field office just to renew their license. That's what I was trying to say. Not that you wait on the whole idea till then. The other thing to think about is there's a lot of interest as members have talked about us being able to do transactions over the internet, and again I would hope to leave some flexibility to be able to do something over the internet with photos, et cetera. And not that I know that we're going to do driver's license. I'm just thinking about ahead of other ways to do transactions versus in person. So if you specify that it's in person, you're getting a new photo issued in person, that will help mitigate some of the costs.
One final question.
Sure.
In the case of Mr. Hopkins and in my own personal case, could I or he go to one of your field offices after a purse was stolen or mail was stolen and ask the question, has anyone else come in and applied for a duplicate license or under my name, to find out, much like getting a credit check done on myself, so that is that information available to me so that I would know that's out there now?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, yes, we can tell you whether any license has been issued against your file since the time your wallet or purse was stolen or whatever it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Any further questions? Oh, Senator Harper, did you?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you can, all four of these things we can do by mail today, KLA issue, renew, replace, or duplicate?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, no, only the renewal.
Only the renewal.
Right. We do originals are done in person and duplicates are done in person at this point in time.
So it was like Senator Beyer, if we just scratch renew, then we're home free.
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, you certainly will reduce the cost. It won't be free.
Why wouldn't it be free?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, the people that come in that don't have, I mean, there'll be additional time to look at a document we may not be looking at today. For example, if we are to pull the photo license up on file to look at it, that's something we don't do today, but we can, you know, could do. That's additional time. Rejecting the people that don't have the right ID, coming back the second time, it may really be Mr. Hopkins who really has lost his license and doesn't realize when he's come in that he needs to have an original birth certificate or some photo, and we have to turn him away and see him a second time. Typically, people who come in for originals have this sort of documentation, not always, but most of them do, and typically people who come in to renew have their old license they're turning in. It's the duplicates, which is the root of the problem, I believe, from what he's describing, and those people come in and typically don't have a photo with them because they've lost it, or they're cheating, like Mr. Hopkins' daughter, the person who did that.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any of you can jump in on this. I'm very sympathetic to this issue. This is a real problem. I'm concerned after looking at it. However, the way it's written, I'm not sure we're going to solve any problem here. And we're talking about people who are stealing identities, and the idea that if they, such in your daughter's case, they get the purse and all this stuff. They duplicate checks and everything else, and all you have to do is make up a student body ID card or a company ID card. The passport, they do that all the time. I mean, they could make that to get the driver's license. Once a thief, an identity thief, that wouldn't stop them if all you do is make that up. So I'm not so sure that we're going to solve any problem here, because they'll just make up an ID card with my name, Danielle so-and-so, with my picture on it, you know, that they'll take to get a driver's license and validate it. So I'd be concerned that we wouldn't solve that problem there. Kelly, you mentioned something in response to Senator Barr's question I thought was very interesting, and that is you can tell if someone has asked for it. I would think let's use this as an example. Let's say I have my wallet stolen, okay, so I'm checking my credit cards and all that, and I also, obviously, I have a driver's license. I'm going to be concerned about that. And if I can call the DMV and find out whether someone has done this, Could I not also call DMV and have it flagged and say, I've had it stolen, do not issue another one? I mean, and because that would seem to really get to it if there was a flag on it and someone came in to a DMV office and it said, oh, Rick Metzger's thing's been stolen and there's someone here applying for it. Does our technology at this point allow us to flag that there is a stolen identity here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, yes, and that does happen. People typically are thinking of calling their banks and such and their credit card companies. They don't always think of calling DMV. But if they do call us and tell us, yes, we can flag the record that identification has been stolen. And, again, try to, when the person, somebody does come in, then question them further. I will say I think that I agree with your comment, and I'd forgotten to mention that we were concerned a little bit about the company identification card being relied upon just because it may be easy to make something up that we wouldn't know was truly a company ID card. I think that the biggest tool that's in this bill is the use of the digital photo that we do have on file. Now, again, we've only got, by the time this bill will go into effect, about 75% of the file populated. But I believe as time goes on, that is going to be the strongest tool we have because it's a photo we have. Yeah, we can buy software to pull it up so that it's each one of the windows that are in a field office to make it go a little faster. And, you know, so I think that that's one of the biggest tools that this bill brings forward.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, just another follow-up. Well, it would seem to me that in the majority of cases, that could be solved by people simply calling the DMV and saying, "I've been, you know, since they can be flagged, and you go to a, even if some of that stuff's down, to let them know that." I would think the other thing might be, though, in solving that, although I could see, you know, the other consequence, just like this would be, you're going to have a lot of, you know, normal people, you know, not crooks, are going to be really ticked off when they find out the new regulations. But the other thing is, could be a delay if it's a replacement or duplicate, in order that someone, say, like your daughter came in and that they either had to contact the information on the file and calling, is this, you know, really, you know, you, we have someone proposing to be you or whatever, before they issue that, rather than just on site. And again, just like this, I mean, that, you know, if you're a legitimate person, you're going to be really ticked off to wait in DMV line and find out you're not going to get it right away. But that would also seem to maybe have a better way of actually getting to the real person. But I think either one of those, I mean, I think it tells us all that we need to be calling the DMV and saying my driver's license has been stolen. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Metzger, once it's been flagged, it's too late. I mean, DMV was very helpful towards me, but they had already the identification had already been fraudulently obtained, and it was flagged.
Yeah. Well, it said on your testimony that it was July 24th, the correct check to DMV, and it was stolen on the 15th.
Correct.
That was 9 days later that they actually issued the check to DMV.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And we hadn't gone down for 3 or 4 days, or until after the 24th, after we got this back, and then we flagged it after I got notification on it.
Mm-hmm.
If I were smart enough, or my daughter had been smart enough to have called, and I think she's a very successful college student, she didn't call to have it flagged, and I think she probably reflects probably a lot of people just in ignorance on that. The other issue too, sir, is that if people were able to manufacture driver's licenses and what have you, they wouldn't be going to the Department of Motor Vehicles to do it. At this point, they can do it, and that's how they are getting their driver, or getting false identification. They're not manufactured themselves, a lot of them, and even as the chair has recommended or said that they're going to the DMV to get it.
What do you think about, if I could follow up, Mr. What do you think about the idea of having that delay, and that is if someone shows up that they can't get it on the spot, that there has to be some verification, and after verification they'll mail it to the address as opposed to giving it to that person?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Metzger, I don't have a problem with that. I just want, what I desire is for people, like, and I have a gentleman in my office, second time, one of my staff members, twice now within a year, they have stolen identification from him. He's in the same boat again.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to provide some way where there is some validating, whether it be photo, birth certificate, whatever, where folks cannot just walk in and just get an identification within, you know, steal a someone's ID, walk in with a Social Security card and a letter with an address on it. I want something more than that. That's my desire. With things that are mailed, people are required to change their address within 30 days by law. And I don't think there's going to be a problem with mailing out renewals and those kinds of things. I don't think there's going to be a problem with that because of change of address. Crooks are going to be changing their address, and it's going to come to me, you know, if it comes to my address. It's the people that do come in off the street that are getting the fake ID.
But if they had to mail that rather than get it personally, it would actually be going to your daughter's address.
So it would come to me because I have to change the address within 30 days. I believe that's still a law.
Yeah, that might be another way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan and Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, and excuse me, I had to leave the room for a moment, and maybe you addressed this question, but when you go in to get a new license when it's lost, do they take your picture again?
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, yes, we do.
So if a person goes in for that false identity, their picture then appears and stays on your record, right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, yes, it does, and that would be available to law enforcement if they were pursuing the case.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan,
yes,
if I may,
yes.
This was done at office number 38, which I believe is West Portland, and we have yet to, I've asked, and we have yet to be able to get a picture from that, from that computer. I wanted to find out who this guy looks like.
I'll give it to you. I think we get it from law enforcement.
Correct.
I'd like to find out who this person is.
We do get those on a frequent
Pardon me?
We do get those on a frequent basis in law enforcement.
Okay. It would seem like that would be a deterrent, you know, not to have your face on, but maybe it is.
No, actually, you guys will love my Measure 11 for fraud crimes bill. It'll put all these prolific people in jail for a long time. You won't have to worry about it.
Some people.
Okay. Any further questions? Discussion. Senator Beyer.
One more, and Senator Metzger left. Now he's back. On the issue of having to mail an ID back to someone, I that would be a hardship for me to swallow because in my case, what that would tell the thief is that, well, I've got to go steal that person's mail again in 3 days. That ID card. And you laugh, but that is what happens. These thieves are checking people's mail. They know which day of the month the Social Security checks come and certain things. They are checking mailboxes in my area on a regular basis. And I'm serious. If they say, well, you know, Mr. So-and-so, we will mail this to you after it checks out in 4 days or whatever, they'd be back in 4 days and I'd lose my mail again.
And I've had my mail stolen too, so I don't tell you.
For someone who's already stolen it, you would be anticipating that they, you know, that you're waiting for something from them.
All righty then. So, do you have any helpful hints and suggestions for how you can make this thing a wonderful bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, like I told Senator Atkinson, I'd be happy to work with them to come up with some amendments and try and bring the cost down.
Would it be better if you just limited it to the counter transactions as opposed to mail?
Definitely, Mr. Chair. I think if you limit it to the counter transactions and if you and again, I'm not sure it's the original renewals because they typically have their photo with them or a photo from another state. But also, I think that the big tool is going to be the digital photo we have on file and being able to bring that up at each window as just part of the transaction. The digital photo has proven we have stopped some frauds from happening because we have enough suspicion that sometimes the crooks are so slick that you know, we don't detect that they're nervous or anything or their story doesn't jive, and we've been able to actually stop it. So I think it is one of the biggest tools.
You guys are getting better, but it's like dragging a hippo out of the mud. In my perspective. Anyway, okay, so you'll work with Senator Atkins and
be happy
come
to.
Up with something. I've been down this road too many times. You know what I mean? I like somebody to actually think outside the box and try to figure out how we can actually do something as opposed to how we can't do something.
Well,
anyway.
And I understand, Mr. Chair, and that's what I was here today was to give you some ideas of how we could make the bill work, get to the problem, and not cost as much.
Do you guys, is there any cross-referencing of reports of stolen identification with DMV? Going back to the flag issue, I mean, is there any interfacing between the databases that, say, the Portland Police Bureau has, PPDS system, or the RAIN system down in Eugene to see how many?
No, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Senator Beyer. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. On the digital photograph, would it be possible for the computer to do this match rather than having to have somebody remember to go look and see if the new photo matches the old photo that was in the computer, that if a photo was taken and the computer compare the new one to the old one and say, wait, this is not a match, and reject it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, it's not that sophisticated of a system. It's simply a photo kept in a digital file. But it it's not like somebody has to match. It, what I was suggesting could happen, and we've looked into it, is we buy the software. So let's say I'm the person at the counter helping you. You're the customer. And you tell me, you come up the counter and you say, you know, I've lost my driver's license, blah, 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 and you give me some identification and things. When I key in your record, it would automatically pull up your photo, and I would just look at you in the photo and say, yeah, it's you, or no, you don't look like him, you know. And so it's not a matter of really having a match, but it does take about 30 seconds to pull the photo up. And when you time that by, if you're doing it against all transactions, we do a lot of transactions. We do over 300,000 in a biennium, so that times 30 seconds adds up. So that's why I'm saying if you can narrow this to the in-counter, at the counter, duplicates, things like that, you'll narrow it, but pull it up automatically. So it just comes right up on my screen. And you don't see the screen, I do, and I know that it's not you. And or I know that it is you, and we go on with the transaction.
Yeah, very true.
All right, we had fun with this one, haven't we? Any further questions? Are you guys set up to do thumbprints?
Mr. Chair, no, we're not.
No? DNA?
No, Mr. Chair, but we've talked about on the vision equipment maybe plucking out an eyebrow when you lean forward or something, but we haven't done it.
Well, I think that thumbprint would solve it eventually.
How about if we just have them renew their licenses at the police department?
Oh, Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
What is the penalty if someone applies for a driver's license that is not theirs? What is the penalty for that?
I believe it's a misdemeanor. And I know we'll, you know, I know we'll cancel it. Is it a misdemeanor, Mr. Chair?
Under the identity theft law, it would be a felony.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been interesting. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. All right, we'll close the public hearing at Senate Bill 665. And how long do you think it'll take to get those Sterling amendments that'll make this thing fly?
I mean, I'll work in the law right
away. 2-3 days?
Yeah, I mean,
great. Thank you very much. All right. Who's my next victim? Let's see. Senator Brown is here for 3, 4, 7.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I understand we're in work session for Senate Bill 647.
Yes, Senator.
Since we last met, I just wanted the committee to know that the good majority leader in the House, Karen Minnis, co-sponsored a similar bill to this. It's House Bill 3023. It provides for criminal penalties for failure to comply with the provisions of the bill. There's been no hearing scheduled. I talked with Representative Minnis this morning. My understanding is the House bill is not moving, and she's going to be taking a look at this bill, and I'm encouraging her to sign on as co-sponsor of this particular bill. A work group met, and I have to thank my staff people who worked this issue very hard, including the work group of the Oregon Medical Association, League of Oregon Cities, newspapers, commercial information systems, and Department of Justice, among others. What we excluded from the bill is public bodies, because we had a public records problem, and narrowed the businesses to include financial institutions, medical offices, and tax preparers. And we clarified language, and I would say narrowed language substantially, and so the bill does not apply to any sale of a record or to the transfer of a record in the regular course of business. And as you may recall, the bill requires businesses to shred or delete personal financial information before disposing of it. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can. I would certainly appreciate the committee's consideration of this issue.
Dash one amendments,
yes.
Product?
Yes.
All right. Anybody out there wishing to testify for or again?
Question.
Anybody have a problem with it? Senator Metzger.
Senator Brown, I saw earlier that representatives from the credit unions and the banks were here, but they've left. Were they part of this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that is of concern. I did have some brief conversations with Tim Martinez way before the bill was scheduled for a hearing. I had not heard from him since, and they were not part of the work group. But my understanding is they were aware that this issue was happening, and did not contact me or my staff.
Okay. Senator Courtney.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 647.
Senator Courtney moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 647. Is there discussion? And just by way of reference, I did speak with Scott Gallant from the American Medical Association. He was here to monitor the gentleman's.
My understanding is, Mr. Chair, that Oregon Medical Association was part of the work group, or at least there was a rep there.
You were part of it?
Yes.
Okay. And I think if Tim Martinez really hated the bill, he'd be here. John Powell's making not necessarily obscene gestures, but. This is the shredding chair, John. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, for your day, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon and State Farm Insurance Companies. And Mr. Chairman, members, I was unaware of the work group. I just saw the amendments. I believe they would apply to a health insurer or an auto insurer doing business under the personal injury protection statutes. I do not know what the ramifications of the bill might be. I believe that these companies do have policies in place to try as best they can to protect any kind of sensitive documents, and it would be on some form of an error that something would escape. But again, I just wanted, for the record, to state I had not had a chance to really analyze the amendments and how they might apply to them.
But if we pass this thing out between here and the House, I'm sure you'll have plenty of time to review it,
Mr. Chairman. In due course.
In due course, yes.
Thanks.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. Okay. Any further discussion? Any objections to the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chairman, Senate Bill 647 is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 647 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. Senator Brown, would you like to carry that?
I'd be delighted.
All right.
Thank you.
Don't say I never do anything for you.
I never do, Mr. Chair. I'm aware of all the wonderful things you do for me on a regular basis.
I'm in an approbation deficit mode today. Okay.
How about a chocolate chip cookie, Mr. Chair?
Thank you. My blood sugar's a little low or something. All right. Work session, Senate Bill 340. Ron Hill, are you coming up here?
Good afternoon.
Counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 340 comes to you from Attorney General Hardy Morrison of the Department of Justice. You last heard this bill back in February, and you have before you set two sets of amendments from the Support Enforcement Division that radically cut this bill back. You may remember when we last heard the bill, the main issue was on page 1, lines 16 through 18, and that was the issue of lowering the amount of money from $2,500 to $500. At which point you could have your license suspended. And you may remember the discussion from the last time, license suspension, and I know Senator Byers and Senator Minnis remember this issue from two sessions ago as a federal requirement, and that language has been removed so it stays back at the $2,500 limitation. What the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments leave in the bill by taking that out is the issue of changing an administrative issue of, for example, on page 1, lines 11 and 12, it removes the Division of Child Support of the Department of Justice or the District Attorney and inserts administrator for clarification. And then also you will see on page 1, line 23, removal of the word a payment, and that's throughout the bill. And that will give the Support Enforcement Division greater flexibility in entering into agreements with obligors, people who owe child support and who would like to enter into some kind of payment plan or some kind of plan besides a payment plan for the purposes of continuing to have their professional license or driver's license or occupational license. So I talked to Renaud Shankle is that they would like to, for example, if the obligor is unemployed, they would like to enter into an agreement where they may actually assist him in obtaining employment and would ask him maybe to go to five job interviews a week. The current statute does not allow them that flexibility. So that's the main part that would be left in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the dash one amendment.
All right. Senator Courtney moves the dash one amendment. Senate Bill 340. Discussion. Any objections?
Mr. Chairman, the dash two amendment. Senate Bill 340.
Senator Courtney moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 340. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 340 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moved. Senate Bill 340 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Metzger, would you carry this puppy?
Okay.
Would you?
Actually, I would probably defer to Senator Courtney on this. Just while we didn't change a lot, the statute itself is one that I'm not as familiar with.
Oh. Senator Duffel.
Okay, well, this bill doesn't do anything.
Who is familiar?
Huh?
Okay. Anything
I would prefer that, just because I'm not an expert on the other ramifications.
Senator Duncan, would you carry this?
And he is, of course.
You don't have to.
Sure.
You don't want to, I'll carry
it. Yeah, but this bill does do something.
So. Then I want to reconsider.
Yeah, you have an opportunity to carry it for a bill that actually does something. All right. Any further business before the committee?
We're not doing 163.
163, no, I'm sorry. It's not ready yet. We've got some issues with respect to the statewide standard for a vehicle pursuit issue. We're trying to resolve those. All right. No other business? We are adjourned.